This is a special feature produced for download from ABC Classic FM's website. Due to copyright restrictions on the music, it's been edited to make this possible.
Margaret Throsby on ABC Classic FM. The role of godparents in the Christian tradition was originally to assist parents specifically in their child's religious upbringing. Today the term's taken on a secular meaning. It can also apply to a person nominated by parents who takes an interest in their child's general development. The American conductor Andrew Litton was blessed by having a godfather who took his job as godfather seriously. How he introduced Andrew when he was just a very young child to the joys of classical music performance is a wonderful and unusual story, and I want him to tell it himself today. Andrew Litton is in Australia to conduct Der Rosenkavalier for Opera Australia and for concerts in Melbourne. He's made some space in a busy schedule for us today. Andrew Litton, our guest, and his music selections reveal a love not just of the classics, but of classical jazz too. But we start with him conducting music by Prokofiev. Wow. The Death of Tybalt from Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev, and it was the Bergen Symphony Orchestra, conducted by our guest today, Andrew Litton. Good morning to you.
Good morning,
and
Margaret.
Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You couldn't resist conducting, could you?
I can't help myself. But I mean, that is the most amazing portrayal of wrongful death in music I think there is, certainly in 6 minutes. You know, I mean, Shostakovich took an hour and a half to do the same thing often, but, you know, it's just such unbelievable drama
Prokofiev
in such a short time.
Prokofiev didn't muck about, did he?
No, it's brilliant. Well, you know, we were talking the other day, a friend of mine and I, about great settings of Shakespeare in music, and that ballet has to certainly be one of them.
Yes. And you've got a direct link, in fact, not genetic, but a direct link experientially, if we can say that, back to Prokofiev and that, haven't you?
Well, I do, and it's sweet of you to mention that. My first job out of Juilliard, in fact, my audition was a week after I graduated with my master's, was as assistant conductor for Mstislav Rostropovich in Washington at the National Symphony, where he was music director. And so I went down there in June of 1982 and got the job. And the first assignment I had was actually watching these recording sessions where he actually recorded this very piece. Now, his link, of course, was he was best friends with Prokofiev and also best friends and a student of both Prokofiev and Shostakovich. And so it was an unbelievable learning situation for me to literally, you know, get it from the horse's mouth, as
Indeed.
It were, from him.
Yes.
And he was a fantastic mentor, actually. He really, you know, he'd show up at my kids' concerts, you know, because that's all I was doing at the ripe old age of 22,
so?
You know. And I'd look and I'd see that famous chin sticking out of him. He almost had a Hitchcockian, you know, profile. And I'd look up and I'd go, oh, no, he's here, you know. And then he'd beat it back to my dressing room almost before I got there, even though I had a much shorter walk. And, you know, Andrushka, what you doing? You know, and it was fantastic. I mean, very constructive teaching, actually.
When you say your kids' concerts, not your own children's, but
no,
these
no,
were concerts
no,
that you...
Yeah,
I'm
sorry, I didn't make that clear. But yeah. As assistant conductor, one gets relegated to basically, you know, the lowest forms of... No, I mean, children's concerts are unbelievably important. And of course, the reason why I'm here is because I was inspired by Leonard Bernstein's children's concerts. So I've always made it my point to take them extremely seriously. But assistant conductors routinely are given those. You don't get, you know, the lofty subscription concerts until some years later. And so, you know, and we'd have orchestras, anybody in an orchestra listening to this knows this full well. You know, you have like 14 back-to-back children's concerts all at ungodly hours of the morning. And, you know, everybody always groans that has to take part. And, you know, he came back, I think he was came to the ninth one of my first ever run of children's concerts in 1982. And I said, gosh, you know, it's so hard to get motivated to do, you know, On the Trail for the ninth time, you know. And his eyes flashed with rage. He said, are you crazy? Do you know what a privilege it is for you to get to conduct and perform this music? Do you know that there are people out there who've never heard an orchestra before? You know, and it was the most unbelievable sort of wake-up call and pep talk I've ever been given.
Indeed.
And I give the same now. You know, I'm kind of an elder statesman. I feel the same way. And of course, it was very stupid and naive of me to be so blasé at that moment, but it seemed so cool when I was 22 to think, well, you know, I want to really do Mahler 3, but, you know, On the Trail will do for now, you know.
No, it's the old story that any experience can be, you know, you can use it sometime in your life, can't you?
Absolutely.
But everybody I know listening is intrigued, hanging off that story that I introduced in the introduction, saying that your godfather played a role, a very vital role, central role, in introducing introducing you to the performance of classical music. Tell me about him. Who
absolutely.
Was he?
Well, his name is Richard Horowitz, and he's the principal timpanist at the Met. And in fact, he first got his job in 1946.
And he's still there.
He's 86 years old, bless him. And, you know, he's just a legend. I mean, there's nobody, I don't think, on the planet that's played a principal instrument in an orchestra for so long. And he's just phenomenal.
Did you say?
1946, yeah.
50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 60, 64 years.
That's correct, yeah.
Wow.
But the thing was this. I was, I guess, about 10 years old, and I'd already been playing piano about 4 or 5 years. And I was going, like all good little, you know, New Yorkers, I grew up in the city in Manhattan, to the Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts. And, you know, it would make a great story, a better story, if I could tell you it was the first one I went to where I had this epiphany. It wasn't. It was like the fourth or fifth one that I went to, squirming like all the other little kids, until this particular day when Bernstein did Respighi's Pines of Rome. And it was unbelievable. I had never heard such sounds and such colors and, of course, sheer volume from a performance source before. And I walked out of the hall. My mother used to pick us up. And I said, Mom, yeah, I'm 10 years old. Mom, I want to be a conductor. And she sort of rolled her eyes and said, yeah, right, whatever. And because up until then, I'd wanted to be a fireman. So, you know, it was it was clearly a sort of jump, although I didn't want to be just any fireman. In those days in New York City, we had those famous, you can see them on old television dramas, those hook and ladders where there was a guy actually driving the back of these trucks because they were so long. Up high.
That's
I wanted
one.
To be that guy. So I already had the position of being looked at, but maybe slightly less, power. I don't know. But anyway, my godfather at this point, Dick Horowitz, stepped in and said, right, if he's serious, he's got to start attending rehearsals and performances as much as possible.
Of operas.
And so starting at the age of 10, I would be seated in the pit next to him. And now the Met pit is completely different from the Sydney Opera House pit. It's mostly out, not covered. And where the timpani are, you can see 2/3 of the stage. So at this point, now you have to do the math here. We're talking 1969, 1970. I got to hear Dame Joan Sutherland live so many times, and Marilyn Horne, and you can imagine the thrill for me when, all these years later, I got to make my New York Philharmonic debut with Marilyn Horne, having heard her at her prime. And it was an amazing experience. And so night after night, I'd sit there for about 6 years, and eventually I got good enough at score reading that he'd actually set me up with a lighted music stand and the score, and I'd follow along. So it was the most unbelievable learning experience because, of course, back in those days, it was the same musicians that played night after night. Now they rotate and roster off. But it was just uncanny to see how the same group of musicians could sound so different depending on who was up there conducting.
It speaks of tremendous tolerance on the part of the management and the conductors and the singers that they'd have a 10-year-old child sitting in the pit.
Well, actually, I don't think they noticed. And it was quite some time until the Met management, actually, in 1976 said, right, something's fishy going on here, because there was a performance of Nozze di Figaro, which ordinarily, might have, 50 people in the pit, and there were about 100. All the teachers brought their students, so they put the kibosh on that one. But it didn't matter. My parents had great subscription seats, and then I'd go stand. I was enough of an opera nerd that I didn't mind standing for Parsifal. It was fine.
But if we take you back to when you first did it with your godfather, when you first sat there and this whole experience of sitting in the pit with, you heard the music always from a funny perspective because you had the timpani banging in your ears, didn't you?
I did, but actually, what was so sweet is back in the beginning, of course, before score reading and all that, I didn't know where the loud, dramatic, crashing timpani rolls were in these pieces because, it's always some dramatic moment when there's this loud timpani roll. And so he'd go, psst, right before he was about to come in with this loud roll, and I'd grab my ears, and this went on and on, And so it was absolutely brilliant. I always had fair warning, and I quickly learned what nights really wasn't wise to sit in the pit, like Strauss's Salome, for example. I spent the whole night with my ears covered, But the Verdi and Puccini and Mozart and Beethoven, it was just fantastic from that vantage point.
But Andrew, you must have conducted your uncle, your godfather.
I did.
So then came the night when you were the conductor.
It was just unbelievable.
When was that?
That was Eugene Onegin in 1989. Actually, this is kind of a sad story. I actually had a ruptured appendix that went undiagnosed, and I just was in agony. So I don't actually remember the opening night terribly well. I sat to conduct, and you know, anybody who's seen my work knows that I'm a kind of a physical conductor, and in fact, somebody in the Opera Australia was shocked that I wasn't going to sit for Rosenkavalier. I said, "You can't sit. There's dancing in this piece. You know, you got to dance these waltzes." But I actually sat like a little old man, and you know, this is 1989, a long time ago. And that was it. I then spent 2 weeks in the hospital, and I was out of commission for 6 weeks. But when I came back, I got to make those Rachmaninoff recordings that you were talking about. So you know, everything goes around in circles.
Everything goes around in circles, and I think that's just so beautifully poetic that you got to conduct with your godfather still in the orchestra, and he's still there.
That's amazing.
In fact, talking of Rachmaninoff, my introduction to you was the Rachmaninoff 2, which was a recording I was given, the complete set of Rachmaninoff symphonies. And I must confess that I'd been a bit sort of, how's your father about Rachmaninoff before that? I'd sort of thought, oh, well, you know, I sort of adopted the idea that he was hackneyed and all of that.
Yeah.
Well, this was a revelation to me, the number 2. When was it recorded and what under what circumstances?
Well, we recorded all the three numbered symphonies right after this illness that I had. It was in the spring of 1989. And we had, this is the Royal Philharmonic, and we had actually three concerts and the three numbered symphonies. So it was unusual, you know, London, so often you just go in, the red light goes on and you record, but we actually had proper concerts at Festival Hall. So it was wonderful. And, this is actually kind of funny, but I had this amazing early introduction to opera, as we just discussed. But the symphonic repertoire I didn't know as well, because I wasn't going to concerts as often as I was going to operas. And it was a history teacher in my high school who said, "You don't know Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony?" And I was probably 15, 16 years old. I said, "Never heard it." He said, "Well, you put on that slow movement, and I promise you, you've never heard anything so beautiful in your life."
And this is it. How can a simple melody be so heartbreaking, I wonder?
Well, that's a genius, and that's why, you know, I'm glad you came around to Rachmaninoff, because, and actually everybody has, you know, the end of the 20th century saw a real return to everybody recognizing his greatness as a composer. It takes, people don't realize how much skill it takes to write a great tune.
Yes, indeed.
You know, and he just had this pouring out of him.
And that's just the first, you know, a couple of minutes of the third movement from the Symphony No. 2 by Rachmaninoff, and we heard our guest Andrew Litton conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra there. I'm just wondering, because you did that complete set and you've conducted a lot of Russian music in your time, Tchaikovsky particularly too. Is there a sort of a link, do you think, with the Russian origins of your family?
I'd like to think so. I think what it is it's, you know, music is a language, and there's certain parts of music that just come more naturally than other parts. And I think for me, you know, obviously American music, I don't even have to think about, you know, but Russian music has just always felt comfortable. You know, this is sort of comfort zone, like, oh, I get this, you know, and so I've always been drawn to it. Plus, I just love the sentiment of it. You know, I'm a very emotional person anyway, and it's just so great when you're making music with wonderful colleagues that you can just vent,
yes,
you know, and all of this stuff. It's,
yes,
brilliant.
There's the sentiment, but there's also terrific wistfulness and terrific sort of sadness in,
yeah,
that music,
yeah,
and in a lot of very up-tempo music, you can hear that the layers of sadness,
exactly,
can't you, of,
exactly,
the history. How far back do we have to go in your family to find Russians?
Grandparents on my dad's side, great-grandparents on my mother's side,
really?
So not very far back.
And was
all.
It a musical family?
Not to our knowledge. I think my mother's dad, who was a World War I general practitioner, MD, he apparently could play piano very well by ear, but by the time I got to know him, he was in his 80s and wouldn't go near one, you know. But he used to entertain his fellow troops in the First World War, and, you know, was in a dance band as well as doing his military duties.
Having announced at 10 that, and with your mother rolling her eyes saying, you know, I want to be a conductor, not a fireman, like I did yesterday, you hung on to that, obviously, and became a conductor. Was it an unwavering force right through your teenage years that
absolutely
was what you wanted to do?
Absolutely. I was like a zealot. This is what I wanted to do. I kept up the piano, but piano at that moment, at the age of 10, became a means to an end. And so even though I still concertized, I have to say, when I turned 40, I had a turning point in my life back to the piano, in the sense that I suddenly realized, you know, after a bad day at the office, i.e. a bad rehearsal, you could actually go back home and sit down at the piano and play a Beethoven sonata and all was great, mm-hmm. you know, or some jazz, you know, and I suddenly realized, you know, piano's not so bad. So I'm actually playing a lot these days, because I think it's really important for conductors who pretty much get a warped view of life. You stand up on a box and tell people who have been playing their instruments since they were 5 years old how to play them better or differently, or how to make this particular piece of music right in your mind. It's very important to remember how hard it is to actually make those sounds. And that's why I love playing still, because I go back and I can't get a passage in a certain piece and I go, this is really hard. And it just reminds you. I think it keeps you humble in a way.
That's interesting.
And focused.
Yeah.
The actual act of making sound is something that we conductors very easily forget. And so I like to keep grounded by playing, and I do a lot of chamber music as well for that reason.
So how do you, as a pianist conductor, but as a conductor, how do you extract the sound you want, that you imagine the orchestra? For instance, the Bergen Orchestra that you've had, that we heard at the beginning, playing the Prokofiev, you've had a long association with them. Now, do you use the same language in Bergen as you would have in Bournemouth as you did in Dallas?
Well, first of all, I love to tell the story how when I left Bournemouth, which is still, you know, a first love is someone you never forget, even if you're over it, you know, I still love that orchestra to bits, and I go back every season. When I left, I was 35, and the average age of the players was 35. I got to Dallas at the age of 35, and the average age of the players was 45. Well, I got to Bergen when I was 45, and the average age of the orchestra was 35. So I finally came full circle. I'm finally that elder statesman, you know, conductor, the way one is supposed to be. But it changes the dynamic very much from the way you are. In Bournemouth, I was one of the guys. In Bergen, I'm very much the Vaterfigur, as we say. Making murdering German, you know, but you know, that sort of professorial maestro that I think one needs to be. I still have a fantastic relationship with
them.
You
mean orchestras play differently for you now?
Well, I think they certainly realize that whether or not they like me, I've been around the block a few times, so I kind of know what I'm talking about, you know. And so it's a different feeling. But, you know, the fundamental act of making music in me has never changed, and that is, I really feel that if we're playing Tchaikovsky, it needs to sound like Tchaikovsky. If we're playing Strauss, it needs to sound like Strauss. Doesn't matter if we're in Norwegian orchestra. So in other words, you can't have a foreign language when you play music, foreign accent when you play music.
That's
you have
interesting.
You have to speak in the language of the music that you're performing. And so
not in the nationality of the orchestra.
Exactly. I mean, the one orchestra that pulls off a kind of, well, this is how we play and this is what we sound like, is Vienna.
I thought you were going to say Berlin.
No, Berlin is, especially under Simon, has become, I think, such an unbelievable instrument vessel that it really does sound, you know, completely different depending on what repertoire they're playing. But also because Vienna uses those very traditional instruments, so it doesn't matter. See, for example, in Bergen, even just talking about brass, for example, when we're playing, you know, the Austro-German repertoire, my brass players will play rotary valve trumpets. When we're playing Mozart, they'll play natural trumpets. When we're playing Stravinsky or American music, they'll play valve trumpets. Well, that changes the sound right there, you know, but it's also wonderful that they want to do that. They love the flexibility of being able to do that, and you know, we make it possible.
I was wondering whether there is a sort of a globalization of sound from orchestras these days, whether the world has become so, there's been this sort of not a homogenized sort of sound, but whether that the easy accessibility of music on the internet or in CDs or whatever, you can hear any orchestra you like, whether there is a discernible American sound, for instance, or a discernible English sound. You're well placed to talk about that because you've worked on both sides of the Atlantic extensively.
Yeah.
Do you reckon there is? I mean,
I think there are still recognizable attributes. Woodwind playing still retains a kind of nationalist color, if you will. And
what leads that? Is it the teachers?
The teachers, yeah. And the upbringing. The thing that has blurred the lines, of course, American orchestras became great with the influx between the two world wars of all sorts of refugees.
Happened here too, of course.
And so you're already leading to a sort of homogenous sound, because guess what? You got Russians, you got Germans, you got Italians, and you got Japanese, and they're all going to mix together and play something. My orchestra in Bergen has 20 different nationalities in it. So you think, oh, this is a little Scandinavian orchestra up in the north. It's not. We have people from New Zealand in my orchestra.
But you also, and you have the passage of people from orchestra to orchestra, of course. And
exactly.
So people, you know, you get a multinational sort of thing happening in an orchestra, on an orchestra platform. I've read in recent years about the terrible plight of American orchestras, financial plight of American orchestras. Has it hit the big ones? We were talking about this in the office this morning. What are the big orchestras in America? I think New York, I think Chicago, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Boston, of course.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh, Dallas. Where's Dallas sit in that? Because that's your orchestra.
Well, it depends. I was there for 12 years. When I was there, I would have told you it was number one. Yeah. But realistically speaking, I mean, we have one of the greatest concert halls in the world. But, you know, I don't think the orchestra's in the top five by any stretch. But it's actually done by finance. It's done by, you know, how big the budget is of the orchestra. And the top orchestras in the U.S. have whopping great budgets. And so the thing is, they usually have endowments to match that. So,
well, what does that mean, having a lot of money?
Well, it means that you basically have a bank account earning interest from donations that sees you through the good times and the bad times.
But you can therefore afford to buy expensive players from other orchestras. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
is it like football teams?
It is a little bit like that. You know, in Norway, it's a socialist country. Everybody gets one salary. You know, principals get one and rank and file gets another. There is no such thing. I can't sweeten the pot if I want to convince you to come. I can just offer you amazing working conditions. In America, we would very often try and recruit and you know, make sure that they were wined and dined and also very much offer more money wherever possible.
How much of your work as a chief conductor of one of these orchestras in America leads to having to do things that aren't musical at all, that are actually being nice to sponsors and sitting next to people at dinners and all of that?
Well, that's a fun question. Actually, well over 60% of an American music director's job is wining and dining and socializing. Because you have to understand, we get no state support. In Norway, I get 85% of our annual budget paid for by the king. In Dallas, we had zero from the state and zero from the national government as well. So you have to literally raise all of this money, and it comes through corporate donors, and through private sector donors. Now, none of those people are going to open their checkbooks unless they feel some sense of ownership, some sense of wanting to belong to this winning team. You know, you talked about sports a second ago. And especially in a place like Texas, you really do have to make people feel like they're an indispensable part of this artistic endeavor. And the only way to do that is to take them out a lot. You can't just, on the first date, expect to get, you know, a seven-figure check.
No.
It doesn't work that way.
You got to schmooze.
You got to schmooze, and you just have to take a look at me to see that I was rather good at that. I ate far too many meals.
I've heard that you're a good cook as well.
No, I'm a good eater.
Now, this is something very special indeed. It's you, but you're not conducting. What are you doing here?
Okay, well, one other side of my musical love is jazz. And
bravo.
Thank you. But it's so funny, because I grew up in this hotbed of classical music, and my parents didn't listen to anything but classical music, I had no exposure to jazz until my 16th birthday. So my friends came over, and one of them, who's actually gone on to be a very famous film director, he did Devil Wears Prada. I don't know if you ever saw that.
David
Frankel.
Yeah.
He brought me an LP of a guy called Oscar Peterson. And, you know, when everybody left, I put it on. I said, well, let me check this out. You know, I took Rosenkavalier off the LP player finally and put on. And I couldn't believe what I heard. It was completely liberating, and I just had never heard piano playing like that. So I grew up to be absolutely obsessed with Oscar Peterson, and I have a stack of CDs that literally, my daughter took a picture of this, stands as tall as me. I have every single one, every single thing he's ever recorded, and then some. And, you know, I'd follow him around like a groupie. I was introduced to him, fortunately. I was working with Buddy Rich a couple of nights earlier with the Royal Philharmonic, and I said to the chairman of the orchestra, would you please introduce me, because I'm such a sniveling fan. You know, I won't be able to get words out, but at least if he knows I'm a conductor, you know, he won't just be dismissive. Well, of course he wasn't, as you mentioned earlier. He's such a nice guy. Hmm. He was wouldn't have been dismissive anyway. But it began this lifelong obsession, and so... one of the first CDs that came out of his playing was a 1983 Tokyo recital with his usual cohorts, Niels Henning Pedersen and Martin Drew. And the first thing on that record, on that concert, is a solo piano version of Round Midnight that's absolutely unbelievable to think that he just walked out on stage and sat down and played this. Well, lo and behold, a couple of years ago, my daughter notices in a music shop that there's a book of Oscar Peterson transcriptions that somebody with obviously far too much time on their hands actually took down note for note from the recordings. Because, of course, this stuff wasn't written down. It came straight out of his head. And I spent 3 months learning this Round Midnight. I was determined to be able to play it. And I finally got it sort of up to snuff, and my dad was about to celebrate a significant birthday. We were recording Petrushka in Bergen, and the mics were set up by the piano. And I said to the team, look, hit record. Let me just do one pass of this Round Midnight, and then you can burn it on CD, and I'll have a birthday present for my dad. And so that's what they did, and that's what you're about to hear. This is me attempting to play, like Oscar Peterson, his version of Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight.
Well, you could have fooled me. That wasn't Oscar Peterson.
No, it was. It was very much me.
Andrew Litton.
Thank
good
you.
Heavens.
Well, the fun part is a friend of mine who's an equal record nutter actually held up his iPhone app Spotify to the speakers when this was playing because I burned him a copy. And it said Oscar Peterson was playing. And so that absolutely made my life.
How fantastic.
That's better than a good review. You know?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful tribute, too. And I think. And you play it brilliantly. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Andrew Litton
much.
With Round Midnight, written by Oscar Peterson. Just fantastic. And Andrew Litton is in Australia for conducting engagements with Opera Australia of Der Rosenkavalier.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that in just a tick. Talk to me about George Gershwin.
Well, you know, I'm a native New Yorker, same ethnic background. I grew up literally 150 meters from where he spent a lot of his adult life, in fact, where he wrote Rhapsody in Blue. He was on Riverside Drive in the 70s, and I was on 72nd and Riverside. So he was actually 33 Riverside Drive. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt this connection with him. And, of course, I was a pianist growing up, and I learned all the piano music. Rhapsody in Blue became a sort of party piece for me. And then, of course, I got to conduct Porgy and Bess many times and that and do the official suite of it, as it were, the it's recognized by the Gershwin family. But I just love the music. I love...
What was so good about it?
First of all, it's so New York. It's got such energy. It's got life and vibrancy. But, one of Gershwin's childhood friends, Abram Chasen, said, George was the only guy I ever knew who could make a piano laugh, really laugh. And I think that joy came out in his writing as well. And and so there's, when one performs his music, one just has this joy. You have this inner joy. And the other thing that is absolutely captivating to me are the melodies, which are unbelievably great. You know, we talked about this earlier. The act of writing a great tune is so much harder than people realize. But certain composers came along, like Mozart, like Verdi, like Schubert, and like George Gershwin, who, when you listen to these melodies, you don't think they even thought a tick about writing them. They just came out. Mm. You know, they probably exhaled melodies. You know, it feels like that. Of course, probably not true. But when you listen to these tunes, you just have a sense that it doesn't get better than this. And so I just, it's been sort of a lifelong love affair. And of course, you know, when you're a young conductor starting out, you're so cautious about, oh, I don't want to be branded as a pops conductor, you know, so you kind of avoid it. But now, like you say, you know, when you get to the ripe old age of 50, you don't care anymore. And frankly, you know, I get to conduct my Mahler symphonies too.
And
so I'm not ashamed of my love of George Gershwin.
And you also do a Gershwin concert, I think, don't you?
When asked. I sit at the piano all night. It's really fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's great stuff.
So you're not a specialist. You don't think of yourself as a specialist, or do you?
I think of myself as a music specialist.
You specialize in music.
This is what I do. I mean, I live, eat, breathe, think music. You know, even my hobby is high-end audio. You know, it has to do with listening to music. Really? You know, I can't get away from it.
It's, where does cooking come into this?
No, see, that's a vicious rumor. I my wife is an amazing cook. I just eat. That's my problem. But
I've heard that if you get invited to a barbecue at the Litton household, Dad is on the barbecue. Is that right?
All right. Busted. But, you know, this is a typical guy thing. You know, you grill the steaks and they're perfectly medium rare like everybody wants it. But then you think you cooked the dinner. And of course, you didn't. You made one course, you know, one part of one course.
Okay, let's listen to some music now, and then I want to talk about the opera. But you've chosen Ella Fitzgerald with Nelson Riddle's orchestra and the song But Not For Me. Tell us about this.
Well, this is a desert island disc for me. Again, right at the advent of CDs, this was one of the first things to come out in the early 80s. And it initially came out as a three CD set of about 60 Gershwin tunes that Ella and Nelson Riddle recorded back in 1959, three different periods in 1959. It's an incredible outpouring of, well, it's a love letter to George Gershwin and George and Ira Gershwin, because, of course, Ira is the one who said, I never knew how good my songs were until I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing them.
Yes.
But I use this example that we're about to hear in lectures when I'm talking about natural phrasing and somebody who just, you know, somebody who didn't go and spend decades studying musical style, just opened up her mouth and sang. And so not only do you have this incredible melody by a naturally gifted composer, but you have this unreal singing that is so beautiful and simple and to the heart. And I think we classical musicians should study and analyze this to the end to realize, you know, that this kind of natural music making can exist, and we should just all emulate it as much as possible.
Just perfect. But Not For Me. Gershwin's song, Ella Fitzgerald, Nelson Riddle's orchestra, chosen by Andrew Litton. That's a lovely desert island disc.
Thank you.
Tell me about the Strauss, Der Rosenkavalier. This is not the first time you've conducted this opera, is it?
Well, confessions, it actually is.
It is.
But it has been one of my favorite pieces since I'm 13 years old. So to say that it's the first time, it's like somebody you've read about and watched your whole life and listened to, and then suddenly you meet them face to face, you know them. You know, this has been such a labor of love for me because, I fell in love with the piece at the Met. You could sit next to the timpanist in this one. It's not that loud. I saw it many times. So Carl Böhm was my first Rosenkavalier conductor. And
do you think you learned from conductors, from watching them from the pit without having to perform an instrument?
Absolutely. You learn, as a matter of fact, the way you learn conducting is mostly by watching. It's the most vicarious of all professions because no orchestra wants some kid to stand up and give their first downbeat.
You were watching, and you were watching from the perspective of a player.
Yeah, exactly.
You weren't watching from the side or the back.
No, and I think it's extremely important also to play under conductor. So I used to play, I played some percussion, but I'd also play keyboard.
Yeah.
All the way through Juilliard, I play keyboard in the orchestra because you need to know, you know, what it's like to actually respond to a downbeat,
yeah.
You know.
So Rosenkavalier is an old love, but this is your debut with the Australian Opera too.
It is indeed, Australia. And I'm kind of a Straussophile anyway. I've done several productions of Salome, and a couple of years ago I did a new production of a rather obscure piece, Egyptian Helen, at the Deutsche Oper, and I'm about to go back to Deutsche Oper in January to do an even more obscure Strauss opera, Die Liebe der Danae, but to actually get to conduct the top tune, you know, the Rosenkavalier, it's been an absolute joy. The cast is sensational. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't have your tickets yet, please come and see this. It's just amazing. Mm. Cheryl Barker, Catherine Carby is Octavian. I think, you know, when she goes home, she becomes Catherine Carby. But when she walks out of her door, she's Octavian.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable how natural she is at this role and just sensational. And I mean, I'm just also the orchestra. They're just lovely, lovely people. We're having so much fun down in our bunker.
Yes, in the bunker, the famously dreadful pit at the Sydney Opera House. It's such a glorious building and such a terrible opera pit, isn't it? And my sympathies go to the orchestras who work there too, because it's totally different from the Met or other opera houses where the people in the orchestra can actually see a bit of the action on the stage.
Exactly. I mean, the one good thing is that we're never too loud, but that's about it.
Yeah.
But they have a wonderful spirit and they play. I mean, their sounds sound so good in spite of the challenge of playing in this sort of, cistern, as I call it. But, you know, the piece is so magnificent. magnificent. And it's just been, I pinch myself every day. You know, when I go to work, I'm so excited. I can't sleep the night before. I can't sleep the night after, because it's just such a blessing to get to conduct this opera finally. And to have, as I said in an email to somebody, to have my wicked way with it. It's just been an absolute joy.
It sounds very glamorous, all this business of whipping around the world and conducting in the Bergen Orchestra or the Bournemouth Orchestra or the Dallas Orchestra, whoever, or operas or whatever. But it's got its downsides, I guess, hasn't it?
Well, the worst part is I have a young family and I'm missing them grow up. I mean, you know, I have an 11-year-old and a 15-year-old, about to be 15-year-old. And, you know, it's you can only go so far on Skype. You know, it's much better to be there. And that's the downside. And, you know, one of the good things about my 12 years in Dallas is, in hindsight, besides obviously the musical joys, was that I was actually paid to live at home. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized now that I'm essentially freelance, although Bergen does take up quite a bit of my time. I don't live in Norway. So, you know, the actual when I'm home, it means I'm not working. Yeah. So, you know, I'm always on the road. And of course, people say, oh, it's so glamorous. You get to go to all these great places. And yes, I have to say that it hasn't been too tough living in Sydney for 2 months. It's such a gorgeous place and people are so nice and the food is amazing. But, you know, there's no place like home.
There is no place like home. You know, well, it's very generous of you to give us some time this morning. Thanks so much for the hour. And we're hearing you with your Dallas Orchestra next playing Shostakovich. What are we going to hear?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the second movement of the 10th Symphony. A movement which, you know, so many people have stories about what Shostakovich really meant, the inner meaning, the secret meaning behind this. Stalin had recently died, and Stalin was, he at various times threatened Shostakovich's life and his family. And so this is basically 3 minutes of hatred, musically speaking. And we think, you know, one school of thought thinks this is Shostakovich's view of Stalin after he had passed. Who knows? All I can tell you is incredibly dramatic music.
Dallas Symphony Orchestra, Andrew Litton conducting, and the second movement of the 10th Symphony by Shostakovich. Andrew Litton is conducting Opera Australia's season of Der Rosenkavalier at the Sydney Opera House until the 30th of October, and the final performance will be broadcasting direct on ABC Classic FM. He's also conducting a concert with the University of Melbourne Chamber Orchestra next Wednesday evening at the Melbourne Recital Hall Centre, I should say. Tomorrow, internationally recognised mind-body stress wellness expert, the link between our emotions and our physical health. Professor Esther Sternberg joins us tomorrow. It's 11.
This feature was produced by ABC Classic FM. You'll find more audio of our programs, along with special features for download, on our website at abc.net.au/classic/audio.